So that's sort of a dire way to start out our conversation. So I want to ask a question. How many people here think that there's a good chance we're going to be able to make a smooth transition to a more ecological way of life? And I'll come back and ask the poll again, but just so you know your choices. And how many people think there's going to be some kind of major discontinuity, major disruption? Okay, how many people think it's going to be sort of a smooth transition? Raise your hand. Anybody think it's going to be a major discontinuity, major disruption? Okay, that's interesting to see. Another question. How many people would say they're ready? Okay, some folks are getting ready. And I know Port Townsend is a location of the transition movement, so I think that may be one of the reasons. So we'll talk more about that. I want to just bring in one other factor here, which is the factor of happiness, because this is an economics of happiness conversation, and it's something that I know all three of these folks have talked about. A number of you may know that in the 70s, something strange happened to our economy. Up until then, in the post-war period, there'd been this increase in happiness that had kind of tracked along with the increase in the size of the economy. Happiness is judged by quality of life and health and all those kinds of factors. But sometime in the 70s, that started to part company. So since then, the economy has continued to increase in size, but happiness has not. And we can talk a lot about what some of those factors is, but I think the inequality that David was talking about is certainly one of them. Inequality, as the research shows, tends to breed unhappiness across the board. Even richer folks get less happy. There's something about being in a society where there's so much difference between the haves and the have-nots, and the lack of trust that causes, and the sense of precariousness. Now that so many people, you know, I remember when I was coming up, I'm kind of old, but when I was coming up, you know, you could get a job in construction or you could get a factory job. One person in a family could support the whole family and put their kids through college. Or you could get a job and work your way through college and get out without any debt. That's a really different place than we're in right now, where so many people feel so precarious. One medical emergency and bam, they could be just ruined financially. Or somebody tries to go through college, they rack up $150,000 in debt. And then they're working their whole adult life to pay it down. There's so many so many jobs are now insecure. So there's so many ways in which our economy no longer provides that kind of basic sense of security. And on top of that, there's isolation. You may have heard the Surgeon General, I can't remember his name, but he worked under President Obama. He's recently been calling out isolation and loneliness as an epidemic proportions. That people are now feeling such sense of not having somebody they can trust, not having that support system, not knowing where they can go when they're having a hard time. He's saying, and I've seen other research that says the same thing, that is as toxic as cigarette smoking to our health. It shortens our lives. If the New York Times Magazine just had a piece on adolescents who are so depressed they can't bring themselves to leave their rooms and go to school. And that's at epidemic proportions. And many people think that social media is making up for that by reconnecting us. But it's actually doing the opposite. It's actually like junk food is to real connection. It's giving us this sense of being connected to each other, but it's actually doing the opposite. It's like empty calories. So there's this happiness deficit. And to me, one of the opportunities of this moment we're in is I think people may be more motivated by the possibility that working in their community could bring them real happiness. They may be more motivated by that possibility and by actually experiencing the joy of being with other people than motivated by fear about the possibilities to come if we fail to change direction. I had some of those experiences when I was on a road trip at the end of 2015 that I wrote about in my book, The Revolution Where You Live. And one of the things that I did is I spent a lot of time with communities in red states and Appalachia and in the Rust Belt, places that people think of as very depressed places. But when I found just those little pockets where people were coming together and doing things together, people were having such a good time. There was just this joy. And I would look around and think, well, wait a minute. I thought this was, you know, a really dreary part of the country, but people are having a great time. And it got me thinking. I actually think there is a source of energy in that kind of joy, in that localized joy, that we haven't even begun to tap into because we're still so busy just thinking about, you know, how do we avert disaster or how do we get through the day with this tough economy or all the other things we need to think about, that we've actually forgotten how much richness there is in life when we connect locally. So I think this local theme is a really important one. Thank you. But I want to just bring up a few cautions around localization. One of them is that our country is increasingly segregated. So during the Civil Rights Movement and afterwards, there was a real push to desegregate. But the truth is that there are a lot of federal policies, a lot of policies on the part of private real estate, a lot of things that pushed our society to become more and more racially segregated, so that now we're pretty much where we were before the Civil Rights Movement. We're pretty much as segregated a society as we were during Jim Crow. So my question is, if we talk about localization, are we really talking about white folks taking care of themselves? And when I've talked to African-American folks about the localization movement, it's been much less a movement that has permeated a lot of those communities. In fact, I visited a fellow outside of Chicago, African-American leader, who said, you know, I saw a talk, it might have been yours, Richard Hardenbeck, say about what was going to come about this potential disaster. And I realized nobody's talking to the black community about that. We better figure out what we're going to do in the case of that kind of disaster. So he started organizing in Chicago's South Side for how they can build resilience, but feeling like it was a completely separate movement. There was no relationship at all with the transition movement. So I'm wondering, how can this transition process and this localization process actually also be working for justice? Because I actually don't think we have a future as a society if it's a future that is excluding certain members of our society. I don't think we have a future because I think we need everybody's brilliance. And I don't think we have a future because I just don't think that an unjust movement has any traction for moving forward. So how do we integrate that fully into the work that we're doing?
Well, I think starting with what you said before about the isolation, I think we encourage everyone to very consciously change the I to a we and change that we with a group of people near where you live, within reach, so that you can, maybe it's only two or three other people who meet together to try to figure out with, you know, the question is, what can we do to avert further social and environmental breakdown? Or, if we want to, we can translate it into the happiness things. What can we do to promote an economics of happiness that is an economics of both human and ecological well-being? The thing, you know, that Sarah was pointing out that is so clear across the world is that isolation and separation is draining us of our energy, it's draining us of our self-respect, and the reconnection has exactly the opposite effect. There are so many examples of what can happen when people come together. Some of the most beautiful projects are things like helping prisoners to talk to each other, heart to heart, in community, while gardening and growing food. There are just magical transformations happening from that. Delinquent youth, angry maybe their whole lives, helped in that way to reconnect to one another and to nature. to avoid the ghettos and the segregation that Sarah is talking about, we need that cross-community interaction and collaboration. And as I was saying, we feel we need it both within nation states, but also internationally. We see a huge deficit in terms of awareness, particularly between what's called now the global north and global south, the so-called less developed poor countries and the so-called developed rich countries. There is a wall that's been created by corporate-funded think tanks that confuse and divide us, and that has had a very, very detrimental effect. I mean, just one example of that is that the sort of funding emanating from big money encouraged environmentalists in the rich world to lobby governments that poor countries should not need to reduce CO2 emissions as quickly as rich countries. That was a complete corporate agenda. In exactly that period, big business was by definition moving to poor countries because they were moving to where labor was cheaper, moving the factories, you know, from America to China, to Mexico, to Vietnam. And they needed plenty of fossil fuels for their big, dirty factories using slave-like labor. But here were well-intentioned Western environmentalists lobbying to make sure that those big businesses had plenty of fossil fuels. That's just one example, but there's a way, and let me just give another one, and that is that in the less developed world, the media and Western-style schooling presents this completely false picture of what's going on in America, you know, which is held up as just the pinnacle of everything we all dream of. People don't hear both about our problems here, and more importantly, they don't hear about our solutions. They need to know about the transition town movement, the localization movement. They need to know that there are all these people trying to rebuild the community fabric and the community economy, trying to lower their emissions, get off the fossil fuel carousel and the destruction it's brought with it. So that kind of bridging of information, I think, is vitally important, and it's essential to avoiding a type of ghettoization and separation.
Thank you, Helena. Did you want to say something?
Given the reality of our global population and our needs, we need to be thinking in terms of a future that I describe as material sufficiency and spiritual abundance for all. And that gets us into the happiness. But that's the frame. Now, if you begin to look at the need to rebalance ourselves in relation to Earth, we need to begin approaching it from a recognition that our very existence depends on the gifts of nature. Earth's capacity to create our soils, our food, and the water on which we are fundamentally dependent. We then realize that there is probably enough to go around to meet everyone's need, but as Gandhi pointed out, not everyone's greed. And it begins to translate into no one of us created this earth and its capacity to generate the needs of our life, which means essentially that no one has a natural right to more of that than they need. Now, this all suggests a very deep realignment politically and power-wise. And we in the United States now, we essentially have two establishment political parties. And a lot of what this last election was about, Bernie Sanders was about attacking the establishment wing of the Republican Party. And Trump was, in a way, attacking the establishment wing of the Republican Party. Now, without getting into the complexities of that, Now, this puts us into context of looking back over 5,000 years of empire. As a human species, we have organized for 5,000 years with a very few people on the top and most people on the bottom. And how did the people on the top keep control over those of us on the bottom? Well, it was by keeping us divided by gender, by race, by religion, by any sort of division that one could come up with to get us focused on competing with one another or blaming one another for our condition. We are now at a position when absolutely, if there is to be a future for any of us, we have to join together and get beyond those barriers. And what we need to do locally in terms of the transformation of our economy has huge political implications. I mean, ultimately, we've got to get control of our politics so that we can change the policies, so that we can do the things that are necessary to move toward greater equality and to better care for our environment. Now, that requires all kinds of local action and local initiative, but as long as the rules are such that the police and the military can come in and alienate us from control of our own resources to give them over to corporations and a few billionaires, our efforts will fail. We have an incentive at this time in our history to come together across all of these lines of separation in a way that goes beyond anything we have experienced in the total experience of the human species. And that's an absolute foundation of what we now do, because at the heart of this, it's not just learning to live in different ways, but it also is getting political control and getting the democracy that we have never had, which we can only do with this kind of solidarity.
I'd just say that for the last couple of weeks, Janet and I have lived in a situation where a lot of these kinds of social barriers have come crashing down because of the disaster, because of the fires. And it's the entire community is profoundly impacted. Suddenly, everyone is talking to everyone else. You know, for days, the electricity is off. Even people who haven't lost houses have, you know, really been extremely inconvenienced. Their place of business is not operating. There is no cell phone service. It's a condition of a community emergency, and people are looking out for one another, having their neighbors over for dinner. You know, shelling out money for emergency services. Contributions for community causes on a scale that we've never seen anything like this before. So as a lot of what divides us is normal reality, the kinds of economic and social structures that we put in place that we think of as being, you know, good, right? And it seems strange to talk about a disaster as somehow helping people in some way. But in fact, it's sort of like war. You know, war is a terrible thing. I'm not saying we should have more disasters or more wars. But people who've been in war situations, soldiers, often come home and they're traumatized almost as much by seeing everyone around them just involved in, you know, going to the grocery store and having 500 choices of breakfast cereal than they were by being in this situation where everyone depended on the person next to them for their very survival, and there was a sense of directness and honesty and the real essentials of what life was about. I'm not saying that disaster is going to tear down the differences between us. It may do so temporarily, but it's really up to us to take advantage of those moments, and there will be those moments over the next months and years to take advantage of those moments to grasp the real essence of community that is still lurking among us beneath the facade of normal daily reality, to grasp that and don't let it go.
Thank you. So it seems to me like there's several different things about this moment we're in that are not normal. One of them is the current occupant of the White House. I think it's really important that we not sort of think of that situation as normal. It's not. It is deeply troubling, and we can talk about how it was that that came to be. But I think it's also interesting to ask the question of, are there any actual opportunities presented by that situation? I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I'm mostly just filled with dread every time I turn the radio on to hear what the latest will be. But it's interesting that that Trump came in with the stance that neoliberalism and globalization, corporate globalization, were not a good idea. And a lot of people who voted for him in part because of that stance. He hasn't shown any evidence of actually doing much apart from not signing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But that was part of his stance. And on the other hand, one of the things that he's been absolutely consistent about is support for the fossil fuel industry. There's been no wavering whatsoever on doing everything possible to keep the dirty energy business subsidized and healthy and making lots of profits. So I'm just going to name a few sort of things I think are not normal and then give each of you a chance to say if you think there's some not necessarily silver cloud, but some opportunity to use this moment as a transformational moment. So one is the role that Trump is having. A second is the new wrinkles in corporate rule. I think it's really interesting that it's Amazon and Google and Facebook that are becoming the uber powerful entities. Amazon kind of enclosing the entire retail world, Google and Facebook working very hard to enclose the internet under their control. Are there any opportunities there in terms of that kind of disruption? And then a third is the way in which people, I think, are starting to get the climate impact. They're starting to get that this is not something that future generations might have to worry about, well, too bad for them. It's something that's happening now, that's upending people's lives, that could happen to any of us directly or indirectly because climate refugees are going to start leaving places that are uninhabitable and coming to lovely places like Port Townsend, Washington, where maybe it will be habitable much longer than, say, southern Arizona. So in any case, those are deeply disruptive phenomenon. So those are three ways, and I'm sure you could name other ways that things are not normal. And I'd just like to see if any of the three of you have some sense of how to use that not normal times to provoke a deeper conversation. I think a lot of people have been very reticent to say very much about the disaster they see coming down the road because it's a bummer of a conversation. It kind of shuts things down, and it's much nicer to say, hey, renewables, you know, hey, local organic food. And was that a mistake? Should we have been engaging with our neighbors in a conversation that says, let's imagine this inflection point before we actually hit it? Or was it the right strategy? Because actually people do need to be cheered up. So one at a time, whichever part of that you want to take on.
For me, that's key is to see that these so-called disruptions are all linked and that whether it's Amazon or climate change or Trump, they're all symptoms of a system that I'm particularly looking at a 500-year trajectory. Because for us, what happened when a few Europeans spread across the world and colonized the world with one worldview and then later on with one techno-economic system, which was meant to, after the Second World War, this system was meant to globalize or integrate economic activity across the globe as a way of avoiding another depression or another world war. So there were a lot of well-intentioned people behind this type of global integration. They ended up structurally supporting the World Bank, the IMF, and very importantly, the GATT, which was a General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. They ended up supporting a system that fundamentally destroyed the local economic fabric worldwide, and with it, the local fabric of interdependence, where people felt interdependent with one another and with their place, where they knew the plants, the animals. Children grew up being able, I mean, even in the 70s, there would be, you know, we contrasted an 11-year-old in India who could identify 117 different plants and knew the uses. His counterpart in the U.S. could identify 100 logos, but I think only one or two plants. I mean, that in a way sort of summarizes what was happening with this type of economic integration into a fossil fuel-based consumer monoculture. Looking at that consumer monoculture can feel like, oh, it's so big, it's too big, and it's too hard to get our heads around it. I want you to see it as an incredible invitation to see the links and to therefore not feel overwhelmed by what seems like separate crises. Once we can identify the systemic root cause, then the localizing path, the systemic path towards supporting worldwide the rebuilding of human scale, interdependent economic systems where we become interdependent with one another and with our place, not in isolation. And, you know, there's a lot more to say. I will have more time tomorrow, but I think There is a huge, huge amount to be gained by taking the time to understand these two systemic paths. And we started raising awareness about this 40 years ago, and at that point, particularly I would say 20 years ago, people were saying, oh, no, but everybody's talking sustainability. The government is talking sustainability. Monsanto is talking about sustainability. Why are you worried? Now, we are coming back from connection at the grassroots on every continent. And really, we can offer you a lot of living, real examples of localization in action. Not enough. But there is enough happening to make us feel that we have more positive stories to offer you. Partly by definition, these examples are small and many. The big bad are a few. And that too, we should see as an opportunity. But I also just quickly want to say that for me, you know, I talked about Ladakh and Bhutan, but I realized that part of what's informed my journey is growing up in Sweden, which was a very homogenous, you know, white, blue-eyed, blonde culture. And it's still being held up as a sort of success story. Part of seeing the bigger picture, you will see that no, already in the mid-70s, when I was coming back to Sweden from Ladakh, I was bringing the story of the economics of happiness. And I was there trying to explain how it was that so many Swedes were so depressed and why there was a high rate of alcoholism. And it was because this modern attempt to bring growth was actually a corporate attempt to bring in prefabricated modern cement boxes to live in, high-rise buildings, driving people off the land, as David was saying, breaking down the connection to nature, to community, to diversified farming. People were lonely and isolated. In the mid-70s in Stockholm, more than half of all the dwellings, there was one person living alone. And I used to give the example of studies that showed even if you have a goldfish in your flat, you'll be happier than just being completely cut off from nature and people. Now, the localization movement is demonstrating what happens when we start reconnecting to one another and to life. And in the middle of the crisis we face, every day there is reason to celebrate, there is reason to connect. But we can't afford to just do that. We also need to organize and to look at the bigger picture. Thank you.
Thank you, Helena. And I'm going to give David and Richard a chance to speak here. But as soon as they're done, we're going to start taking questions from the audience. So if you have something you want to ask, you could start winding up.
Well, you put a lot of of difficult related questions to us. And I've been sort of trying to sort out in my mind what are some kind of common frameworks that might be helpful. So here's a question. Are you a globalist? Are you a localist? Or are you a glocalist? You know, this is really interesting because in some ways we think, you know, being global is really progressive. This is inclusive of all people. And it's those conservatives that want family and community, and it's local control. And yet many of us who identify as progressive are also beginning to think very local. And, you know, this was a kind of an unresolved issue in this political campaign, and it's still playing out, and our problem is we just don't have the adequate frameworks to think about this. So first of all, I mean, I would guess I'm not the only person in this room that celebrated their 80th birthday, and at least a number of you have celebrated your 50 or 60. Or
can we see a showing of hands from 80 or above?
Am I alone? Oh my God. Hey, you don't know what you're going to do when you grow up until you're 80. Yeah. Okay, interesting. Well, young folks. I mean, those of us of an older generation will recall a time when, you know, our major communication vehicle internationally was snail mail. And that was true when Fran and I lived in Ethiopia. That was our mode of communication. So it's pretty stunning in terms of thinking now, wow, I got my cell phone, I can contact through Skype or whatever, essentially anybody in the world. And it's, if I got the right connections, it's essentially costless beyond my regular fee. We are a global species, in a way that we have never been before. And we are an interconnected species in the sense that we've talked about. I mean, either we are going to survive as a species or we will not survive as a species. That's a common interest, global scale. Now, on the other hand, as we come to understand life and how life organizes and the logic of life, all of life's decisions are local. Think about the cells in your body. You've got tens of trillions of cells in your body. These are all individual living organisms that are all interconnecting with one another, and they're all making decisions and so forth to create and maintain this organism that we know as our bodies, that is the crucible of our consciousness and the mechanism of our agency. We always used to think that was all through the nervous system, but most of it is some form of direct communication between the cells. And our global ecosystem is a system of individual organisms, many of them microorganisms, all somehow communicating, all making decisions. But that's always local in terms of the organization. As you begin to understand it, it has to be local because of the need for adaptability. It has to be adaptive locally. Now, within this is also a recognition that life exists only in community. It can only exist in communities that self-organize to create and maintain the conditions of their own existence. So we are a global species that has to learn to live and work locally. This gets down to essentially a fundamental principle of market economics that I learned back years ago when I was in business school, but it's been certainly forgotten by most economists these days, that you want your materials and your physical production to be predominantly local and self-reliant, and that is the way life works. Life exists with local energy, with local nutrients, with local water supplies and so forth, and organizes around those. At the same time, as a global species, to navigate the transition we have to navigate, we need to share our beneficial technologies and ideas and so forth, and do that absolutely freely. So what have we done as a global species in terms of our economy? We have opened up so that we get our food from the other side of the world, and we ship in water in bottles from France to the United States and so forth, and then we privatize and secure our intellectual property rights and our knowledge of our technology and charge exorbitant prices for anybody from another country that wants it. So we have it absolutely backwards. Okay, here's another fundamental organizing principle. Jane Jacobs, who was a great thinker and urbanologist, planner. One of her fundamental principles is this is not her language, but it's essentially the concept. We have a choice. We can either organize around living communities, or we can organize around legal incorporated bundles of financial assets that we call corporations. You think about that organizing as a global species, and what we've been doing through our trade agreements and so forth, our international agreements, is organizing as a global species around incorporated pools of money, which control more and more of our means of living to put us in a position of servitude if we want to live, if we want access to food, to water, to any of the things that are essential to our lives. If we're going to have a viable species, we have to organize globally as local communities that organize around living beings, around living systems, around the environmental resources that are essential to our survival and being and our health and happiness. So again, we've got it exactly backwards. So we've got a little work to do.
Thank you, David.
I want to say a few words about putting the Trump phenomenon in context. There's been a lot written in recent months attempting to do so just in the context of American political history, and a lot of that's very good material, but that's not what I have in mind. I want to try to summarize some ideas in a paper that I have in peer review called Energy and Authoritarianism, and it's already been published in one form, in which you can find at resilience.org or richardheinberg.com anyway. Just a few highlights. What I sought to do in that paper was, first of all, put authoritarianism in an anthropological, historical perspective, which is that we're not inherently authoritarian as a species. During most of our existence as hunter-gatherers, we lived in extremely egalitarian social settings. But since the agricultural revolution, most state-based societies have been authoritarian. In the world today, I'm using data from the Democracy Index, which is put together by The Economist magazine, of all things. According to the Democracy Index, a minority of countries in the world today are democracies, and they have a very complicated set of indices that they use to analyze the governance systems in 162 nations around the world. And it turns out that there are what the Democracy Index calls, you know, true functioning democracies, then flawed democracies, and then all the way down to fully authoritarian regimes. The U.S. in recent years has moved from a full democracy to a flawed democracy. Now, what I try to tease out in the paper is what are the general trends in the world today? And the general trend is toward moving lower on the scale, generally speaking. Especially a number of Eastern European countries have moved from flawed democracies to hybrid regime, what the authors of the Democracy Index called hybrid regimes or authoritarian regimes. And that seems to be the dominant trend in the world right now. A possible explanation for this is increasing stresses on existing regimes, financial and economic stresses, ecological stresses, and social stresses caused by increasing economic inequality and other factors. So that's kind of the context in which Donald Trump has appeared. And the impact of Trump, of course, as we all know, is increasing political polarization within the country. So it's increasingly difficult for various political factions within the country to communicate with each other. We demonize each other. We have fewer common ways of describing the world and understanding the world. And this is fatal for democracy. The only way to counter those trends that I can see is to work at the local level, where there is the opportunity for face-to-face interaction, and we can begin to get beyond political stereotypes and demonizing attitudes. So another trend that is happening politically in the world is the increasing breakup of larger polities into smaller ones, whether it's, you know, Brexit or Catalonia or potentially, you know, California. Who knows? I'm working on an essay right now called Catalonifornia. We'll see what happens with that trend as well. But I see it as being very much related to the longing for connection and democracy and getting away from the polarization that is making our lives miserable in this country right now.
Thank you, Richard. So we have some questions. What I'd like to do is take three different questions and then give each of you an opportunity to respond to whichever combination you want to do with those. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you for being here. This is very life-changing for all of us to hear from each of us. And what I would like to interject is that 51% of the global human population are women. And women have survived this insanity for, what, millennia? We have, women, according to Oxfam, have 2% of the property and 10% of the money. How do women survive with this kind of inequality? We're not talking about Hispanics, blacks, we're talking about all women coming together. And how do we work? We work with cooperation and with trade that's not based on the monetary reality. So we have survived. Maybe this is a new paradigm that we have to come together and see cooperation as the common denominator, as different from looking at the outside world. There is a man, there are two men that I really, who I really admire and love, and one is Jeff Lawton, who takes the desert. May I just
wrap up in a question, if you could.
Yes, the question is, how do we get the men on this planet to turn into Bunker Roys and Jeff Lawton, who take women and applaud their intelligence, our intelligence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. So we're going to take two more questions, and then we'll give you a chance to... Yeah.
Okay. Me? Okay. You've seen me nodding over here in the chair. And I used to help organize some of the Rolling Thunder Democracy Fair, so I know the Cortons, who've been speakers many times back in the early 20s. 2004 was a festival, 2002, like that. And I've spoken to Mr. Heinberg there. I had invited him to be a speaker at one of our events that we were planning. So I have to tell you that all of you guys, after I have found you and listened to you and, you know, podcasts, alternative radio and all these things, I started to put a lot together. I used to live in Norway. I have the ability
to do research. Could you give us your question?
Okay. Thanks. Well, the thing is, I've been finding local connections for politics that are actually frightening to people, like water rights and such, here in Washington State. And when I went up the ladder to the various, you know, hierarchies, it led back to the United Nations. Now, I understand the history of what you were saying and what Richard was saying, and the change there. The question is, in the future, as we try and transform to a little bit better way of living, is the UN part of this global structure or not? Because I can tell you, there, it's a uniting issue between left and right. Only they don't know it yet.
Thank you. That's an interesting and probably complex issue that I'm not sure how far we'll be able to get on tonight, but we'll give it a shot. Okay, that's going to be the last. I'm sorry.
Okay. It seems to me that we're in a real crisis, and I like local, that's great, and there's this idea of having a crisis event that makes change happen. Thank you. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, there he is. Yeah.
So, but really what we want is for just us to be able to go into the global system and tweak a few levers and have the whole system be different. That's what we want. And a lot of us are doing like with the, we're looking for the keys under the light instead of where we lost them. That's what we need to do. We need to find the answer that actually is going to solve the problem in time rather than kind of, fool around and some of this other stuff that looks possible. Oh, I guess the question is, does that... Maybe you could comment on that. What's your strategy for like actually solving the problem fast?
Okay, so we have three really big questions, and we're also just about out of time. So I apologize for not getting to the questions earlier, and what I'm going to suggest is that each of you take a minute to sort of say the summary thing that you'd like to say to people. For right now, we have the weekend, so a lot of these questions can come up in the workshops and in other conversations, and I apologize again that we're not going to be able to give them the full attention that they deserve. So, summary statements from the three of you, about a minute each.
Yeah, I think undoubtedly, people who are thinking deeply understand that we are talking about a system that's fundamentally patriarchal. We need to shift to a system that genuinely supports a feminine perspective, feminine values, and women themselves. However, we, I think, also know that it's not as simple as just getting more women into politics, more women into the corporations. we're talking about a systemic transformation. And that systemic transformation will not be helped by putting faith either into the UN or into the current systems, political or economic top-down systems. So what we're looking for is a transformation, which I will talk more about tomorrow. There are some examples of building up a momentum from the bottom very quickly. But it is understanding how we need to, as you said, not just tweak, but transform the levers that are continuing to centralize power, both literally energy power and political power, into the hands of fewer and fewer. What are the levers whereby we transform it into more localized power? So it is fundamentally about a shift from global to local, but it is not about just thinking local and acting local. There is a big problem there, and I'm actually worried about the reluctance of localists to travel. Part of what we're saying is every localist needs to have a foreign policy. And in order to have a foreign policy that's grounded in experience and intelligence, we need to have more deep communication and experiential knowledge. We're being manipulated and divided, both across the world and within our communities. So communication, international collaboration is part of the picture. But it's not as complex as it might sound, but it takes a little while to rethink,
okay. At
least in terms of what we're saying.
So we'll get to hear more about that tomorrow night. Dave.
Yeah, just in terms of one thing, one rule change we make globally, has to do with corporations. Corporations exist only when a government issues a corporate charter. Now, there is absolutely no legitimate reason for a government to issue a corporate charter except to serve a public purpose, which was a concept in the early United States. It's a concept that we should revive. If you're going to be a corporation, you have a public purpose, and you'd be accountable for fulfilling that purpose. Furthermore, you have no particular right to exist outside of the jurisdiction of the government that issued your charter. So if we... Just imagine the difference that that would make if this was our fundamental principle for issuing corporate charters. Just to start.
So what's the solution to the problem? Well, there's one. Yes, but the point I'd like to make is that that's a very crude, instrumental way of framing the situation that we're actually in. It's a systemic crisis, and you have to learn to think in systems in order to begin to understand the interrelated crises of our food system, our energy system, our political system, our financial system, the global population, inequality. All of these things are related, but just saying they're related doesn't shed much light on them until you begin to study them individually and the relationships between these aspects of the global problematique, as it used to be known in some circles. So there is no single, silver bullet. It's going to require a systemic change in order to address the systemic problem. And that sounds incredibly difficult and obscure, but actually, as you study the systems, they all come to focus in every community. Every one of those systems is present in every community. So the levers are there for us to grasp. And it's by doing so that we begin to understand the relationships between not just the problems, but the opportunities and the solutions and the relationships that we have with one another that may even be obscured to a very large extent by the system that we're talking about. So once again, it all comes down to us and where we are.
I just quickly want to say, I'm being obnoxious, I know, but I hope to be able to persuade you that just as the globalizing corporate economy is a problem multiplier, so localizing economic activity is a solution multiplier. And I've got lots of evidence, and I hope, you look at our website, because I won't be able to cover it all, but it's a solution multiplier.
Okay, well, thank you all very much. Thank you for those excellent questions. To be continued this weekend.